From Entrepreneur Media, this is Problem Solvers, a show in which entrepreneurs do what entrepreneurs do best, solve unexpected problems in their business.
We were completely wrong.
And I'm just like, it's not selling.
It was like, we have to start from scratch.
I'm Jason Pfeiffer, the editor-in-chief of Entrepreneur Magazine. Andrew Wilkinson has a catchy way of describing himself. He says that he's gone from barista to billionaire.
20 years ago, I was a barista, and today I own 40 companies, so it's been a very strange ride.
And what does it mean to own 40 companies? What it means is that he is the co-founder of a company called Tiny. It is a Canadian holding company that buys and holds what it calls wonderful businesses for the long term. And as you can probably tell from the barista to billionaire thing, this was not on Andrew's bingo card. This was not the thing that he was angling to do. He interestingly just kept following opportunity all the way up.
The way it started was I was a barista and these two guys kept coming into the coffee shop where I worked and sitting on their laptops all day. And I asked them one day, what do you guys do for a living? And they said, web designer. And I went, okay, being a web designer seems a lot better than being barista. Maybe I should try that. And that's where it all started. I started designing websites, taught myself web design, started designing websites, started freelancing. And then I just over and over again kept compounding and growing my knowledge and figuring things out as I went.
And a lot of people have a story that's like this. They spotted some interesting opportunity, they made a change, they pursued it, and suddenly their life is different. The thing about Andrew, of course, is that he did this and then just kept leveling up over and over again to the point where he has enormous wealth and is controlling enormous value. And what is it that drives someone to do that? Even if you don't achieve what he has achieved, I think that if you're listening to this show, you can relate to this sense of wanting to constantly grow and pursue this idea that there is just never enough. And that phrase, by the way, used very intentionally because Andrew just wrote a book called Never Enough. And look, the book explores his own journey, lessons learned and mistakes made on the journey to building a fortune. But the reason I wanted to talk to him was because in Andrew, I figured here is someone who has been very thoughtful about what it means to pursue and to grow and when and where to stop, or if stopping is even an option.
I think a lot of people get to a certain point and then are satisfied and they coast along at that level. And frankly, I think they're probably much happier than I am.
Because I feel this quite a lot. Again, I'm sure you do too, is we just keep growing. And every time that we achieve something more, we just want something more. It's never enough. And how do you find a balance? And has he? Anyway, these were the big questions that I wanted Andrew to answer with me. And I have to say, I am incredibly delighted by where he went. The conversation that we had was so deep and thoughtful and personal. And if you have ever grappled with your own question of what does enough look like, this is the conversation that you need to hear. And it's all coming up after the break. Grow your business with one of the world's most trusted brands in retail. With Walmart Marketplace, you can scale with built-in solutions for fulfillment, advertising, and pricing, all while reaching a customer base of millions. Sellers who join today can save up to 50% on referral and fulfillment fees. Launch your store on Walmart Marketplace before July 31st to lock in your discount. Head to marketplace.walmart.com/solvers. That's marketplace.walmart.com/solvers to get started today. Conditions apply. All right, we're back. I am talking with Andrew Wilkinson, co-founder of the holding company Tiny and author of the new book, Never Enough. And Andrew's origin story, as you heard a moment ago, is he was a barista and then he got interested in web design and then he got interested in bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger things. And he describes this as stumbling his way through success. And I wondered, I've heard stories of many people doing versions of that. They didn't know where they were going exactly, but they just got there. I guess that's everybody, isn't it? That's me. I didn't plan on being editor-in-chief of Entrepreneur Magazine. I just kind of kept doing stuff and it grew. And my question to Andrew to start in this ultimately very deep conversation about what it means to be in a position of never enough and to figure out how to find happiness when nothing ever seems to be enough is to ask him, how do you get into this situation in the first place? What drives someone to just keep growing?
Yeah, I think it's a general dissatisfaction. There's a great James Dyson quote. He says, I'm perpetually 20% dissatisfied with everything. And if James Dyson's story, so he's the inventor of the Dyson vacuum, and he's gone on to great success, and he's now one of the wealthiest people in Britain, but he has a very traumatic childhood. And I think that he had there was something missing for him. He didn't have a father. And his strange way of channeling that pain was to become a great designer and engineer. And I think that still drives him. And I think what I've seen in most successful people is that they have some sort of, there was once a football coach who told them they weren't good enough for the team, or a dad who didn't hug them, or someone who didn't tell them that they were adequate in some way. And I see that in myself as well. Not, you know, I don't have capital T trauma, I have lowercase t trauma. But growing up, I was always surrounded by people that I perceived to have more than me, and I felt inadequate. And it stoked me for whatever reason. And so for me, I think that it's just been a general feeling of being dissatisfied constantly and always feeling I need more money to solve that pain. For me in particular, my parents would always fight about money. And so I think at a very young age, I went, okay, how do I make them stop fighting? I get money. And that is just inborn. That's like a genetic thing now inside of me. And so I think a lot of people get to a certain point and don't have that and then are satisfied and they coast along at that level. And frankly, I think they're probably much happier than I am and many other successful people. Yeah, I don't know. That's what I've observed as I've met more and more successful people.
I've heard a version of that answer before. In particular, I remember Barbara Corcoran from Shark Tank telling it to me. She carries with her sister something, some teacher at a Catholic school that she went to, telling her that she wouldn't amount to anything. And she seems to still feel like she's talking to that teacher or proving something to that teacher. And she said that the entrepreneurs that she wants to invest in are the ones that also carry that, because it means that they will not stop when things get hard, because there is something deeper inside of them that's driving them, and it's a hole that they're trying to fill. Here's the thing about that hole. At some point, does it inhibit you from appreciating or enjoying enough of the thing that you have done? I wonder if you feel that as someone who now gets to call themselves a billionaire, that you're also carrying around at least 20% dissatisfaction. Is it a 20%? I'm curious. Is it a 20% for you? Is it larger? What's the percentage dissatisfaction?
I think it's it's about maybe call it 20%.
Okay. Is it still useful to you?
Totally. And I think that's partly why I wrote the book, is I reached this point where it was, at first when I was running my business, call it 10 years ago, I had enough on paper. Like, I could have retired and had a nice life, and I had a very adequate amount of money for whatever I needed. And then I was like, you know what? I really just need to make sure that's bulletproof. Let's get double that. And that process continued over and over again until finally I had taken a business public and I looked at a net worth statement and I saw hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars staring me back in the face. And I still felt that feeling, that pit inside of, is this all there is? Have I arrived? The anxiety isn't gone. It's still there. And I asked myself that, is this really functional? Is this helping me in any way? And what I've found is that it has reached a point where it's actually a burden. I write about this in the book. If you spend the money, your life gets more complicated. people think you're a jerk because you're driving a fancy car. You now have to have a staff of people because you have three houses and they're constantly asking you questions, and that's stressful. Your family members think you're being flashy or whatever it is. There's just so many odd downsides. And I think wealth, frankly, is really not something that continues to add value to your life past a certain point, past being able to have a really great house and a great car and go on vacation and pay your bills. I don't think it delivers any happiness. And in fact, I think it's quite negative. So for me, the book was working out, okay, what do I do with the byproduct of my anxiety, right? Like, I've gotten very good at using my anxiety for productivity, and I've been very productive, and the byproduct of that is money. And I don't have a good use for that money, yet I'm still working really hard. And so I was really trying to figure out, okay, what's the ethical thing to do with that money? In my case, it's I want to give it all away for the most part, which is an unsatisfying answer as well, because it becomes a burden in and of itself. Great, now I've got to make a foundation and figure out how to give it away, and people criticize how I give it away or whatever. But that was the conclusion that I came to personally. But yeah, it's not... The book, ultimately what I wanted to do was show my experience to other young entrepreneurs like myself who think that adding zeros is going to make them happy, and really show that it doesn't, and that I wouldn't recommend it. And I read a couple books that were similar when I was younger, and unfortunately I didn't listen to the advice. It was very poignant.
Dave Eggers wrote a novel many years ago that I really loved called You Shall Know Our Velocity. And do you know it? The story is about a guy who inherits a lot of money. I can't remember exactly where the money comes from. And he finds it to be a tremendous burden and wants to give it away, and ends up just traveling the world trying to hand it to people physically. And the burden that is that, possibly worth reading. But what you're saying there really resonates to me, not as someone who has earned that much money, because I have not. But I'll share this. In that, let's take this job. So I'm the editor-in-chief of Entrepreneur Magazine. People think that's cool. And it is. It's cool. I spent a lot of time working in magazines, and then I got to have the best title at one that people know. And the thing that I did almost immediately as soon as I got the job was that I started to think, what else can I get because of this? Where else can this get me? And then I have spent the vast majority of the time that I am editor-in-chief of Entrepreneur Magazine, which is I got in 2016. Here we stand at 2024, so it's been about 8 years, trying to answer that question. I still do the work of entrepreneur, but I keep, in my mind, I keep trying to remind myself that it is an accomplishment all its own. That is, it is an honor that I carry, that I should be able to look back on this time and say, I held that role and it mattered to people and I enjoyed that. But instead, I think all I'm going to think is I held that role and I was trying to figure out where else can I get. And for me, what I do is that I get involved in other projects. I create other things. I travel around and I talk. I'm just doing whatever is afforded to me because of this role. And I do grapple with this question of whether or not that is the right way to handle the thing that I have at this moment. And so I want to double click on the thing that you said a moment ago about helping founders understand that the money isn't all that there is, that the money won't satisfy them. And I want to get there. But before I do, I just want to ask you if what I just said about appreciating or trying to appreciate or remembering to appreciate or not appreciating the position that I'm in is a thing that resonates with you. And if you have figured anything out for yourself about how to appreciate the position that you're in.
Yeah, it's really, first of all, it totally resonates. And I was going to say, I think accomplishment is like ice cream. You can eat a lot of ice cream and you're always going to want more. Yeah. You never take your last bite of ice cream and then say, I can never eat. I don't need to eat ice cream for the rest of my life. I've eaten a lot of ice cream. You notice that the craving very quickly sets in a few days later, and that it takes more and more ice cream to satisfy the craving. It's like a drug. And I think that accomplishment and achievement is this wonderful thing when you're doing it for intrinsic reasons. So if you enjoy writing, let's say you love writing fiction and you write it because you love it, and it just so happens that other people love your writing, I think that's wonderful. But if you're writing because your dad always told you you're a bad writer. And so you're writing to impress your dad. I think that's a really negative thing. And so what I've found is that if I'm in line with my values, with my intrinsic desires, and I'm achieving for those reasons, I'm doing things that actually bring me joy and I would do regardless of any extrinsic validation, then I think it's wonderful. Work can be so wonderful. But I think that as soon as you get caught up into status, that's just a pool of misery. And I think one of the hardest things about getting successful is that people start to put you in boxes. They say and you had a great post about this on your newsletter, actually, about how people will assign all their value to a title or a box. So they say, I am a really good stock market investor, when really they should be saying, I'm actually a really great thinker and analyzer, because that allows them to move from stock market investing to running a nonprofit or whatever it is, and applying that same skill set. And I think, a lot of people get caught up in those things and lose themselves and end up doing a lot of things that make them miserable. In terms of what's actually brought me real happiness and joy, usually it's presence. So being in the present moment. And so it's walking in a forest or reading a book or flow states like that. And then frankly, lasting satisfaction, really the only thing I can think of is my children. Having kids and seeing them grow has been really satisfying. And I look at all of my professional achievements, and I think that kind of pales in comparison, which is such a lame answer. And it's for people, I remember not having kids, and I'd always hear people talk about their kids, and I'd just be like, oh, that's so lame. But I think there's like a biology to it. I think that you really unlock a certain chemical in your brain when you have kids. And for me, that chemical has been unlocked, and I derive a lot of satisfaction from that.
It's funny you say that at this moment, because I don't know, maybe I don't have enough of that chemical that's been unlocked. But I keep running into these moments where, I'll give you an example from literally 5 minutes before you and I started talking. Here on June 3rd, 2024, at 4:38 p.m., which is when I'm saying these words, just before you and I started talking, here's what happened. I sent an email to a speaking client. I did something with that speaking client last year, and they paid me very nicely, and it was wonderful. And then I spent the year staying in touch with them because I wanted more. Never enough. I wanted more. And I lined something up, and it's good, and I'm happy, and I want it. And then we realized it was just going through the schedule with my wife, we realized that it conflicts with a school thing for my kids. And my wife feels very strongly that I am at that school thing, which means that I got to email the speaking client and I got to tell them that I cannot make it work on their schedule, which probably means that this deal is going to blow up. And I do not know how to find it inside of my soul to say, to feel good that I am sacrificing the work thing for the school thing, even though it will be good for my kids, even though they will be happy that I am there. All I can think of is I would have made more money this year if that speaking gig came through. And now I will make less, and I'll have one less thing. And I do not feel good about that. And I do not know how to reconcile that. And you are not a therapist. So I'm not asking you to untangle it for me, but I'm sure that you've had these conflicts too. It's easy to say the things that I love in life are walking through the woods and taking care of my kids. And that's wonderful that you have that. But surely these things also come into conflict with that desire for more. And how do you navigate that?
I think it's a really hard question. And I don't know that I've figured it out. I think when I have a really good therapist, speaking of therapists, and I was talking to her about this exact problem. And she just said, look, I want you to reframe. When you say no to something, you're saying yes to something else. And when you say yes to something, you're saying no to family, kids, time to yourself, all the things that make you happy. And so what I've tried to do is use a framework. You might have heard of it. I love the writer Derek Sivers. He talks about the idea of hell yeah or no. And something is either hell yeah or no. And I often find the things that make me miserable are the things where I go, I should. Whenever I use the word should, that's a big flag that there's something going wrong for me. And I try, when I hear the should word, and for you, do you really authentically want to get on a plane and fly to Ohio or wherever you got to speak and do that speaking gig? I don't know, but the money's nice, right? You should make the money. It's a should. And The way I would think about that is, will that money actually make a real impact on your life or not? Or is it a should?
Yeah.
Because I think I'm like you, like I've got a newsletter too, and I charge ads on the newsletter. Now I don't need to, right? Obviously, like
yeah.
I have a successful business, but I have this thing about me where I go, well, if I'm going to do something, I'm not just going to send out this newsletter without charging for it. It costs me money to run it. And I've got a team of people that help me put it together. So I should get my money's worth. But I very quickly find myself going, man, now that means I've got to do the occasional phone call with an advertiser. Now I have more email, et cetera. So I think that's an example of a should in my world.
What you just said made me think this. To the question that you asked, do I really want to get on a plane and go to Ohio? It's actually Vegas, which is even worse. I think I'd rather go to Ohio.
Oh.
The answer is like, not exactly, but what I really want is the momentum of that business. What I really love is that I built that speaking business. And to me, everything that I do either enhances it or it makes it go slower. And so even though the individual grind of it sometimes doesn't resonate with me, the having have built it and having have profited from it and the deep satisfaction, personal satisfaction of creating it, that I do like. But here's what was so interesting. And maybe this is a subject for your therapist as well. But like I should get a therapist, but is when you were talking about should, here's what happened in my brain. I thought, you know what I have done? I have attached the should to the thing that I should do for my kids. I should be there at that thing for my kids. And because that's the way that it's framed in my brain, like the thing is, you're not taught, you don't need to be taught that should feels bad. Should inherently feels bad. But the thing is that we don't recognize what we're doing when we think that we should do things and the way in which the should feels bad. So here I have said, ugh, I should be there with my kids. That is what my wife basically told me. You need to not do this because you should be there with the kids. And that means that the should is attached to the kids. And that's why I'm not feeling enthusiastic about it. Maybe the thing that needs to happen is that you need to recognize where you have placed the should and then take it away and then say, wait, I shouldn't be thinking about how this is something with my kids that I should be doing. Maybe I should be thinking about why this is so valuable to be doing. And that it's not just about recognizing where the should is, but it's also being intentional about where the should is being placed. What do you think?
Mm-hmm. I think that I do that same thing. So for example, I've got a field trip that I'm going on with my son and it's 4 hours and we're canoeing to an island where we live in Victoria. His school is right on the beach. And every year they do this thing where they canoe to an island and they have a little field trip out there. And so I'm going and it's one of those things that I naturally resist because I've got a lot going on at work and it's hard to take a whole day off. And I don't really want to go and put on boots and go stomp around on an island for 4 hours with a bunch of grade ones.
I'm right there with
you. But I know that the risk is, the downside is so significant because if my son thinks, if he even has the thought, I wish daddy was here and it's something that I could have done, I think that's just so tremendous in terms of downside. Like my father was wonderful. My dad's actually really a lovely, warm dad. I've been very lucky in that regard. But I remember when I was a teenager, I was really obsessed with computers and I started this website writing about Mac news and he would never read it. Mm. I'd always tell him about it and he'd always say, I'm so proud of you, but he would never read it. I always wanted him to read the articles and I'd tell him about the articles, but he wouldn't read it. And I think that I'm okay. That's fine. I'm a relatively well-formed person. I don't know that's like traumatic, but it definitely affected me, right? It gave me this feeling of I'm not being paid attention to and I'm not being seen. And so I just worry about anything like that where my kid is trying to show me something or has an event and is looking for me in the crowd or whatever it is. I'm really scared of those things because of that. And I guess I wonder also with this thing is, could you go on ChatGPT and say, write me a very emotional response to the speaker people and explain the situation and say, I am so choked, but I need to do this for my son. Because I think it's such a universal thing. I think if I was hosting an event and you canceled on me, I'd be mad. But if you told me that it's because my son has this thing at school, I would immediately be like, oh my God, go, it's fine, we'll reschedule. So I don't know. I think one has total potential downside and one has very limited downside.
I think that's a really good way of thinking about. To me, that resonates a lot, is measuring the downside. I don't know, maybe it's because I'm a logical thinker, but I know how to measure downsides of things. And yet, I think sometimes you overlook the downsides of things. One downside is concrete, one downside is abstract. For this particular example, the downside that is concrete is loss of income. The downside of that is abstract is, I don't know how my kid's going to think. So you have to make that concrete, or you have to engage with it directly and deeply in the same way that I'm going to engage directly and deeply with the question of the lost speaking gig. And for what it's worth, that is exactly what I did when I emailed the CMO of this company. I explained that it was a family thing. And I know exactly what he's going to say, because I've gotten to know the guy. He's going to say, I totally understand. I do the same exact thing. He's not going to be angry at me. I totally get it. I think that measuring things by downside, I don't know who needs to do that, but I think I need to do that. So that's a really useful observation.
One thing I would add too is there's a downside to this as well. But the problem is, if you build your business around you, where you're going, you need to go to speak and you're the product, versus you build a business that's a machine and you set it up and you hire the people, but ultimately it can operate without you. I think you could derive the same satisfaction, potentially more money, without that personal cost of downside and time, right? I think one of the hardest things, I think being like an influencer or a celebrity or actor or something like that, the worst part of it is if you get tired and you don't want to do your thing, if you stop dancing, the money stops for the period with which you take a break. Whereas if you can build businesses that are more automated, and maybe that's what you're doing with your newsletter and other stuff, but yeah, you just lose your income. And I grapple with that too, because we own like AeroPress, the coffee maker company. And I made the decision to buy it. I hired the CEO. I helped them hire a few people. But the problem is, and I make money from that business without having to do any day-to-day work. But at the same time, when they ship new products, I'm not proud. Mm-hmm. I'm proud of them, but I don't feel a sense of pride like I didn't work on it. And I think this, ultimately, it's such an interesting decision of how much do you abstract away business and money making? Are you an individual practitioner, or do you build companies? And if you build companies, how involved are you? And I think a lot of people can give themselves over to their work in a way that they lose themselves in it, where they have to be giving 100% of themselves. And I think the cost of that is so huge.
Yeah, I think you're right. The challenge I have, for what it's worth, again, not to make this a therapy session, I'm actually going to pivot to a different subject in just a second, but is that I really love being the product. And not because of an ego thing, but because for a person who is in the business of ideas, which is generally what I think of myself as being in, there is just truly nothing more magical than being in front of people, sharing ideas, seeing them interact, and then having them come up to you afterwards. I love that. And unfortunately, the only way to do that is to keep getting on planes and getting in front of people. But you're right that it is not scalable. And it creates all sorts of conflicts that wouldn't exist if I had just built a machine that made the money instead. So I don't do that kind of stuff just because of the income. I do it because it is the thing that excites me. And there is some kind of balance that needs to be struck where you find the thing that gives you the energy even as you spend the energy. And for me, unfortunately, a lot of those things are the very unscalable things. So that's just, for whatever that's worth, maybe somebody else can grapple with it. Let me ask you this, because I want to be respectful of your time, so we've got a few minutes left. I'm going to go back to something you said, who knows, 20 minutes ago, before we went down a rabbit hole of shoulds, which was about how you had realized that all the money in the world could not be fully satisfying, and that you had heard that and you didn't internalize it. And so you had to discover that for yourself. And now you're trying to help other founders who maybe think that there is some very satisfying pot at the end of the rainbow that quenches them of their thirst, for whatever mixed metaphor that was. And here's my question to you, Andrew. Is that really something anyone can learn? Or do they have to only learn it for themselves?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think that people can learn. You can learn from reading a book, obviously, but there's many things that I've read in a book that I've then gone, that person's different from me, I'll go do it. One example is I have always loved restaurants, and I'd read a million books about how restaurants are the worst business imaginable and they're very difficult to operate, but I'd had a lot of success in business. And about 10 years ago, me and some friends decided, let's open our own restaurant. We're great at other businesses. Let's try that. And so we did. And it was utterly humbling. We got our asses handed to us and lost all our money. And I think I've done that with a lot of things. And I think that ultimately, I always think you want flesh wounds, not mortal error or fatal errors, right? You want little scar tissue. You don't want to gore yourself. And so I think it's okay to try a lot of stuff and see what works. And there's a lot of things you read that are incorrect. There's some people that would say, starting a business is so risky. Why would you ever do that? And then there's other people that say, starting a business is the only way. Both are correct, depending on your context and who you are and the industry you go into and everything else. So ultimately, I do think everything for me has come down to personal experience and having some really brutal failures and low moments. I've read a blog post called, I think it was called People Don't Change. And it was all about how the only people rarely change. And if they do, it's only when they hit rock bottom or have a really negative experience. You alluded to, I had a bad experience with somebody that I hired, and I was really trusting before I went through that. I'd always had this whole, I'd watch like a movie and there'd be an evil villain. And I'd always think people like that don't exist. That's, people are good, inherently good. There's no such thing as like an evil person. There's just misunderstood and complicated people. And then I interacted with someone that I felt was really not a great person. And I realized that there's narcissists and psychopaths and all sorts of colorful folks out there. And now I have a very different take on how I diligence people and how I trust people. And it wasn't until I hit rock bottom in that circumstance that changed my opinion on that. So I don't know. I think that ultimately you do have to go and stick the forks in the electrical sockets. And hopefully you can do enough research to know roughly what you're in for. I do think that it's instructive to read books and learn other people's stories, but sometimes you're just drawn to something and you got to go do it.
Yeah. What I think about a lot is the phrase, youth is wasted on the young, because it feels true when you get older. I don't know how old you are. I'm 43.
I'm 38.
38. Okay. When I hit about 40 is when I stopped sleeping well, and when running down the street meant that I would be sore the next day. And anyway, yeah, in a way, I guess youth was wasted on the young. But also, I think, no, that's not true at all. Because the only way to have gotten to the perspective that I have right now, or maybe I feel that way about the decisions I made when I was young, is that I made those decisions. And it was the act of discovering that shaped my ability to appreciate what I discovered. And maybe to kind of bring this full circle, maybe the way to grapple with that persistent emptiness of never enough is to try to fill it. And to try to fill it as much as you can, to fill that hole that doesn't get filled, to fill it and fill it. And only through that process will you discover what it means to actually fill it. Which, by the way that you explained it, is to have sidestepped it entirely. Your answer at the very beginning, which was about time with kids and walks in the woods, that is to stop trying to fill a hole, to not even be at the hole, is to walk away from the hole, is to build a mountain next to the hole. That's the way to do it. You would have never, ever known that unless you poured $1 million into that hole. What do you think?
Totally. No, I agree. There's a great Bob Seger line, which is, I wish I didn't know now what I didn't know then. You know, I wish that I could still run into battle thinking everything will be fine and not knowing all the stress of what's to come. I think there's a really wonderful thing about being young and being able to just move forward with anything. I think when I was 20, I could come up with any dumb business idea and I'd have started a business within 3 hours. And now I have this mental framework of that's a low margin industry and it'll be hard to hire people. Right. And I'll think of the stress that's coming and, oh, I might have to raise money for that. And who would I raise money from? And I think that's it's wisdom, certainly, but it also sucks the fun out of it in a big way. Mm-hmm. And I think it's this like Zen Buddhism realization of ultimately all there is the present. And sitting, what's the great Pascal quote? It's all of man's misery arises from an inability to sit quietly in a room by oneself. And I think that's very true. I think that ultimately the happiness does come from quiet and presence,
yeah,
and not acting and not doing things. And don't get me wrong, there's a joy in being generative. I think Paul Conte, the famous psychologist, talks about how you need agency, gratitude, and generative drive. So you need to have the freedom, feel you have the freedom to do the things you want to do. You need to be grateful for what you do have, and you need to have generative drive, this drive to go and create. But I think how you spend that generative drive is really important.
And will change over time. Andrew, mm-hmm. This has been a just really enlightening conversation. I really appreciate it. What do you want people to know or take action on right now?
Nothing really, to be honest. I wrote my book. It's coming out July 9th. It's called Never Enough. And it was really my own exploration of this idea. I'd love for people to read it and let me know what they think. But otherwise, I don't need anything from anybody. I would just love to hear what people think.
That's fantastic. Usually people just hard pitch their book, but I like how you were like, you can get the book, but I don't really need anything from you, which feels like the perfect lesson to have learned after a life of never enough. Andrew, thank you so much.
Thanks, Jason.
And that's our episode. I would love to hear what you think and maybe even about a problem that you solved. You can find me at my website, jasonfeifer.com, JasonFeifer.com. Also, I have some more useful stuff for you. I write a newsletter about how to future-proof yourself and become more adaptable and optimistic. I would love for you to sign up. It is at jasonfeifer.bulletin.com. Also, check out my other podcast. It's called Build for Tomorrow. In each episode, I take on some belief that we have that holds us back from progress and show you why it is not as bad as you think. Problem Solvers is a production of Entrepreneur Media and comes out every Monday morning, so make sure you're subscribed so you don't miss an episode. Thanks to Deepa Shah for production. My name is Jason Pfeiffer. See you next week.